Tested is sponsored by Duke Health, where cancer researchers have made it possible for patients to receive stem cell treatments at home. More information at dukehealth.org. Tested also receives support from Hungry Harvest, delivering farm-fresh produce and kitchen staples to your door starting at $15. Every delivery fights food waste and supports local hunger-solving organizations. HungryHarvest.net.
I'm Dave DeWitt. This is Tested from WUNC, a look at what today's challenges tell us about where we are, what we believe, and who we want to be in North Carolina and the South. Today, to conserve fighting strength. At the top of every episode, we say the title. It's something we started doing when we began Tested, and now we're, to be honest, a little stuck with it. It's usually something sort of vague but hopefully relevant and gives you a sense of what to expect. But today, we're using the motto of the Army Medical Department. To conserve fighting strength means to support and care for our nation's soldiers. But right now, during the COVID pandemic, it also means using that medical expertise to treat civilians who have gotten sick.
You know, for me, this was really an opportunity to put some skills that I've developed for a decade and a half into use. My name is Dave Hostler, and I'm an Army pulmonary and critical care doctor.
Dr. Hostler is stationed at Fort Bragg in North Carolina. When the pandemic hit in March, he was working at Womack Army Medical Center, helping the base develop its plans for taking care of COVID patients while also working in the intensive care unit. But then, in the middle of the summer, Fort Bragg received a request for help from a civilian hospital in McAllen, Texas, a city located right on the state's southern border with Mexico. Dr. Hostler quickly decided to join a medical team of 86 doctors, pharmacists, chaplains, and more to travel to South Texas to answer the call for help.
For most people, 2020 has been a series of unpleasant surprises. It has for me too, but I'm in a unique position to have trained and practiced things that make me useful. And so the opportunity to go to where I was needed most was one that I jumped at.
A school day going on as well.
Oh, great.
Okay, well, you make your book.
Today, Dr. Hostler is back at Fort Bragg, living with his family in Pinehurst. Our producer, Charlie Shelton-Ormond, recently met with him at his home for a safely distanced conversation about his experience providing relief in Texas.
Yes, now his larger experience includes providing care in lots of different environments. Dr. Hostler, who actually goes by Dave, says he's worked in multiple ICUs, he was the brigade surgeon for the 82nd Airborne, and he's treated service members in combat zones in East Africa. But he says his time at the hospital in South Texas was unlike anything he's faced.
This was the most challenging practice environment that I have encountered, not only because of the volume and complexity of disease, but because in a stateside hospital, we're generally accustomed to having every resource that we could need. And that wasn't the case. While we could eventually get our hands on some sort of workable solution, there were definitely times where either we didn't have a medication, we didn't have a machine, or we didn't have a person. And that last piece is the most important, really. You know, you can come up with creative solutions for missing medications or a different machine to do a task, but there's no creative solution to replace a trained human being.
Dave tells me he served many different roles at the hospital in McAllen, Texas, but his expertise is in pulmonary care, which means treating the respiratory system and the lungs.
So we would, you know, when a patient's respiratory failure was worsening, our team were the ones who generally went to intubate them, to start them on a ventilator. When there were emergencies or pulseless arrests, our team was generally the team that responded. Early on, when the number of patients was highest and the severity of illness was pretty unchecked, that could be a lot. I think the most we had was 19 pulseless arrests in one day. And for those who don't know, way outside the norm for a hospital, right? Even a really busy, you know, university trauma center doesn't have 20 codes in a day. It's a reflection of the severity of the illness and also of how overwhelmed the system was, that there weren't the resources before our arrival to deal with problems before they became emergent.
When he arrived with the rest of the team in mid-July, it was all too obvious how overwhelmed the hospital was and how much the facility needed specialized care.
Some of the areas of the hospital had been retrofitted to be intensive care units when they were not designed for that. The first place that I was brought on my tour of the facility was a neonatal nursery. You know, just like you might see on a sitcom where you walk up to the big glass window and you can look at all the cute babies swaddled in their bassinets. But instead, there were about 20 adults on ventilators, some of them on dialysis, most of them laying on their bellies in the prone position because that helps with treatment. So that was sort of a shocking first thing to see. And throughout the hospital, there were patients whose severity of illness exceeded what would ordinarily be on the ward, right? So on a ward that would usually be for less severe illnesses or for patients who were getting ready to go home or perhaps even in rehab, there would be folks who were on ventilators or on a lot of oxygen who were very ill.
And unfortunately, the patients weren't the only people in the hospital who needed relief when Dave arrived. The medical staff had been dealing with this surge in cases for more than a month at the time, and their exhaustion was undeniable.
On the one hand, there was kind of a collective sigh of relief when our team arrived that there is some help here. But at the same time, we could see that people were having difficulty seeing the light at the end of the tunnel.
So, Charlie, did Dr. Hostler tell you about the types of patients he was treating in the hospital?
He said he treated patients from all ages and backgrounds, and one of the hardest things was witnessing how much the virus affects whole families. He said at times he'd be treating multiple people from the same family at the same time.
In this area of Texas, multi-generational living is very common, and so it was a story that we heard over and over again that there are three or four generations of the family living in the same house, and the working age generations have jobs where they can't stay home and got exposed and brought an infection home. And it was the older generation, maybe the parents and grandparents, who ended up becoming ill enough to be in the hospital. And there were a few times when our team cared for multiple members of the same family. We had a father and son in rooms next door to each other, and a cousin down the hall. And that family showed just an example of what can happen. The youngest, the son, was in the hospital for a few days and went home. The cousin, who was a little bit older, was sicker and stayed in the hospital, and the father unfortunately died. And so for our team, having taken care of this family, feeling like we were part of their family, this was really difficult. And because of the visitor restrictions that almost all hospitals have in place right now, having to tell a son who we had just sent home, your father died, and the cousin down the hall, you know, your uncle died, without them being able to kind of come together and have that closure of being present, that was really challenging.
You mentioned arriving at the ward and observing some of the medical staff experiencing, you know, some fatigue and some burnout, just going through this really hard and grueling environment. Did you experience or have to navigate any of that through your 2 months there at the ward? How did you take care of yourself while simultaneously taking care of so many COVID patients?
Sure. Yeah, I think it's incredibly important. And self-awareness is important for care providers. So I'm really fortunate to have a life coach who knows intimately my challenges, because my wife does exactly the same job. And so when I would have a difficult day, I would talk with her. And if I felt like there was some futility after a particularly difficult day, she would remind me that if you did one good thing for one patient, then that matters. And that went a long way. I think too that especially on a small team facing a common obstacle, taking care of each other, you get more than you give. And so in either moments of downtime in the hospital or evenings after work, just having conversations with coworkers who are dealing with the same challenges and providing support to them, you can kind of convince yourself that things are going to be okay too.
What would you want folks to know, sort of coming away from your experience, to really keep in mind about what is happening, sort of on a day-to-day basis, in treating patients and what people are going through sort of on the ground more so?
So I'd say a few things to that. First, the numbers are important, but they're only the headline. They're not the story. Every case, every hospitalization, every death has a ripple effect. Every patient has a family or is a member of a community in some way, and their illness or their loss affects others, some of whom may also be sick, others may not. That's really easy to see in a hospital or in a clinic, but it's easy to miss when we're watching the news and we have pandemic fatigue. I would say too that what we do in the hospital to treat patients with coronavirus disease is very labor intensive. The treatments that we have right now are of variable efficacy. Even our best treatments may not be effective for people with severe infection. And it's really reminding us that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. That simple things that are in the hands of our neighbors who are not medical are much more powerful than the tools we have in the hospital. If there's something that you can do at home to prevent your loved ones or your neighbors from getting sick, that's going to go much further than any treatment or cure that we have in the hospital. And I think that's empowering for our community, that it really is in the hands of the average citizen to take control of the situation.
Dr. Dave Hostler is an Army pulmonary and critical care doctor stationed at Fort Bragg. Hang tight, more in a moment.
Tested is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. And this is a good time to say thanks to everyone who supports WUNC. Whether you're an individual donor or a business, we can't say thank you enough for providing us with the resources and opportunity to serve the state of North Carolina with up-to-the-minute news and information. Everyone at WUNC is working around the clock to do just that at this unique and perilous moment in our history. And we couldn't manage without your help. So thanks, and if you are able, please go to WUNC.org if you want to donate for the first time or to maybe increase your support.
Clinical trials are ongoing, but hopefully in their final stages. And all along, discussions and planning have been ongoing about distributing the hundreds of millions of doses that will need to go out. So who's first in line, and who will have to wait? Last week saw a milestone in that effort as North Carolina released its proposed plan for how to distribute a vaccine. First on the list is critical healthcare workers at high risk of exposure, essential workers, and long-term care staff and residents.
So you've got exposure to high-risk situations that might be because of employment. And then you've also got, you know, chronic conditions that might put people at higher risk of severe illness if they were to contract the virus. So those are sort of the two buckets that landed in that first phase of the priorities.
Michelle Reese is the interim director of the North Carolina Institute of Medicine. The organization helped facilitate discussions over the vaccine's distribution. The state plans to release a vaccine in four phases of distribution, assuming that people will ultimately need two doses of the vaccine. Reese says as the state prepares for the rollouts, transparency will be crucial in the steps ahead.
We've already started a lot of this outreach with various community leaders, faith leaders, advocacy organizations, and so forth around understanding all of that work and trying to figure out, you know, people's concerns are, What are the messages about the vaccine that people need to hear? What are the stakeholders that we need to pull in to make sure that, you know, that people are getting the information that they need from a trusted source? And who are those trusted sources, right? That is sort of like the next phase of this work, is trying to figure out how, okay, so if there's a plan now that the state has, how are we making sure that the information that people need about that plan is available and is coming from people that they trust?
That's it for this episode of Tested. I'm Dave DeWitt. Charlie Shelton-Ormond is our producer. Special thanks to Rebecca Martinez. Lindsay Foster-Thomas is the executive producer. Thanks for listening.